I think of him as pure evil. I think that if there is a devil, then he's probably the devil or the devil's son. I've had a dream about this moment, and I would actually stab and kill him, but then I never knew it would happen.
But when they were married, I think it was 14 years, 13 or 14 years, Cindy came to me and she said, "Mom, I'm not happily married. You were right. I should have waited longer." She said, "He's not the type of person I want to be married to." And I said, "What?" You know, because I thought they got along pretty well. He was fun to be with. And she said, "He's very, very possessive. He won't even let me wear a bikini at the beach." And I said, "Oh, really? I didn't even know that." And all this time we were having great times with, you know, at picnics and over at our house at Christmas time and Thanksgiving. And we just had a great family unit. And she named several things that I didn't even know what was happening. She said, "I can't even go out in the evening, go shopping or anything, because he's afraid a guy will pick me up or something."
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, live from London, criminal behavioral analyst, founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. And with me, live from LA, is
Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague. He's not with us today because we really wanted to talk to Laura to get her input on the Dirty John episodes that she wasn't able to chime in. We did two episodes with Christopher Gofford, the author and reporter on Dirty John, and Laura was only with us for part one. So as you know, when you hear part two, I was channeling her so hard and wishing she was there. So now we thought we would just do an epilogue and kind of tear it apart. But before we do that, Laura, tell me about the picture I saw of you today.
I mean, there's been a few posted today. It's been incredibly busy. And, you know, I've got to say it's now, you know, in the evening. And after my busy day, I just really wanted to talk about Dirty John and some of the analysis on it. And it's wholly relevant to what I was doing today. So my day was quite insane. I started with an early session delivering a masterclass on coercive control, the subject we're going to talk about, and risk and the law and homicide prevention. And I was working with one of my colleagues, one of my associate trainers, Shona Dillon, and we used lots of different case studies, and that's the best way that people learn. But one of the cases, Lisa, you'll be interested to know, was Nicole and Ron, where I played to them the 911, because obviously this is a problem across the world. It's not just located in one country. And we got them to analyze and assess Nicole's letter that you and I discussed, the letter that was submitted in the civil case that just showed so many aspects of coercive controlling behavior.
And Laura, what episode is that? That do you always remember the episodes better than I do? Do you remember?
Well, I don't remember the detail of it, but you can go to all of our podcasts, because it was kind of sequential that we went through it. Mm. So I think you need to listen to all of them. It was in, you know, some of our first ones that we did after Making a Murderer. But, you know, just some of that analysis. And I think so many people just didn't really understand the case, that this wasn't just something that happened out of the blue, as people say. There was so many behaviors of her being closed down and the separation and her just feeling entrapped by him. You know, even about her pregnancy, you might remember that he said to her, "Well, having a baby weighs 7 pounds and therefore you should only put on 7 pounds, which is insane." And her mother saying, you know, he thinks that you won't put on any weight. He thinks you won't get fat. And then her just talking about all the things that he prevented her from doing. So it was a very powerful class, but I couldn't stay until the end because I was then due in Parliament to speak at a parliamentary group, which was in the old shadow cabinet rooms. And it was with Labour ladies, incredible group of baronesses and MPs. And I addressed them around stalking and online abuse and coercive control and why the register that you'll recall our episode with Zoe Dronfield, which I think was episode 36, where brave Zoe spoke out about what happened. And we've been campaigning for this register for serial stalkers and domestic abuse perpetrators to be put on our sex offenders register and managed under our public protection arrangements. And the system already exists. But I was talking to them in there about how it would save lives, like Zoe, and why she should be victim number 13 when there was a whole history. And we've had lots of other cases where there's been, sadly, you know, murders, Shana Grice in Sussex, which I've mentioned before, and Alice Ruggles, her family, was speaking out today. I've been looking in the whites of the eyes of too many families whose loved ones have been murdered, who want change. And this is one of the key changes that could happen. So I left there, Zoe and John Clough. Zoe Dronfield came to meet me, and I was with John Clough, whose daughter Jane was stalked and murdered in Lancashire in 2010 by, again, another serial abuser. And we walked off from Parliament to Number 10. And Number 10 Downing Street, that's where our Prime Minister resides, along with Larry the Cat, who has his own Twitter handle, funnily enough, that's incredibly popular. He's also the same Larry the Cat who photobombs various prime ministers. He's very amusing. So we went there. We had quite a lot of press come with us to cover the story. And we handed in our petition, where we've had over 130,000 of you, our lovely listeners,
wow,
and people signing the petition. And so many of them talking about their own experiences of being stalked. And, you know, simultaneously, we had questions asked in the House of Lords by Baroness Jan Royal, asking the government to include them within the violent and sexual offenders register. And that happened at 2:45, and we handed in our petition at 3:00. So there's been a huge amount of publicity around it, and I'm so honoured and privileged to spearhead this campaign with victims, with Zoe and John, survivors, I should say. And it really is the voice of the people speaking. You know, there's an overwhelming groundswell of support, and I have to say, evidence for this to happen. I feel so strongly about it in my 20 years of policing. And it really is a quick win for the government. So, yes, we had the obligatory photos taken there. I posted, I believe there are a couple of John, Zoe and I at the Number 10 door, and one of the obligatory one on my own. No Larry the Cat photobombing me. Which would have been a lot of fun, I have to say. And the security there were fantastic. You know, we chatted a lot to one of the guys on the door, the security, and handed in the petition. I wish it were
right,
the register. So it's been a huge day for us, and such an important day as well.
That's really huge. And I don't know, you know, beyond this side of the pond, if we can fully comprehend what the equivalent would be here, but I feel like it must have been just a huge effort to get this done, you know, like walking up to the White House and handing, you know, in a petition or, you know, whatever.
Right.
So good for you and good for Zoe. It was great to see those pictures of you. And I love the shoes, I have to say. I know I'm not supposed to, but I love those shoes you had on.
That's okay. You can love on the shoes. You know what? I had to put grown-up shoes on today. The gold Converse were in my bag. And funnily enough, I was in Parliament and I was switching my shoes out, thinking I should wear grown-up shoes in Parliament to present. And one of the baronesses came up to me and she said, "Oh, I loved your gold shoes. You should carry on wearing them." And I said, "Well, I would if I could." And they go on immediately as soon as I leave this room.
Right.
It's good to be comfortable. But yeah, grown-up shoes were needed today. And yeah, it was, you know, I've been to Number 10 a number of times. But today, you know, it was different having Zoe and John with me. And in fact, John was with me the last time when I changed the law on stalking. He was one of the key people who gave evidence. And, you know, as everyone knows on this podcast, we're all about putting the victim's voice at the center of everything we do. And it's not just about talking about it. This is about action. And for me, it's not just about words. You've got to actually stand up and be an advocate and, you know, basically create platforms for people. And, you know, I hope that this will create real change. And we already met with the minister a couple of weeks ago, actually at the beginning of September, and she assured us that this would happen. But the key thing here, Lisa, is that we want to hold, it's called the government's feet to the fire. We want to make sure that they are absolutely focused on this, and that when they're doing all the other things they're doing, because there's going to be a new act on domestic violence that the Prime Minister is committed to bring in. I just want to make sure this doesn't get lost, because it really will save lives. And, you know, an average murder also costs about £1.54 million to investigate. So this makes sense in humans costs, but also in financial costs. And we want the police, having worked in them, I know that they're busy, I know that resources are strapped, but they've got to be busy with the right dangerous people and protecting victims. And this is about helping them use the right risk tools and have a legislative framework, a statutory duty to track serial perpetrators and to monitor them, robustly supervise them. And they go on a system, and it's not the victims that are told repeatedly, well, there's nothing we can do, change your name, move address, you know, disappear yourself. And then the perpetrator's just left, you know, unchecked to do whatever they want. And that's why we clock up so many victims, and it's got to stop. And this is a quick win. I mean, the framework already exists, but it does need a statutory, you know, push for it to happen. And police colleagues support it. And you know what? It just bloody well makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, such a practical, pragmatic approach. And that's what I always come with. You know, we've created, I've written lots of reports that show the evidence base. In 2003, I wrote a report from the findings from the domestic homicide reviews. And people can Google that. And it made the recommendation for the risk assessment dash and for the register. And the same in 2004, a paper called Getting Away With It, which tells you exactly what was going on with the perpetrators, profiling them. And when people get away with it, guess what they do? You know, it's a really obvious thing. They just keep going, and then they escalate their behavior because it's left unchecked. And of course, we're going to talk about this, you know, as a nice segue through to Dirty John, you know, which I've talked about in every training session as well. So, you know, I really enjoyed chatting with Chris, and you know, it's just a case that absolutely needs a spotlight on it. And also those, you know, who understand coercive control and stalking behaviours talking about it. And, you know, so many people just don't understand that behaviour. And I've got to say, you were spot on. I was listening as I was running, doing my morning run. I was listening to you and Jim talk about it because, of course, you were recording when it was 3 a.m. and I could last until about 2 a.m. and then I had to call it and go to bed. And, you know, I was really upset to miss it. But I've got to say, you guys did a great job, and you were spot on by, you know, you've learned well by us talking about cases like Nicole and Reva Steenkamp. And, you know, you were saying the things that absolutely I would have said. And, you know, and there's more, of course, yep, that, you know, we wanted to talk about. So I'm really pleased we could find the time to, you know, jump on the Skype and talk about this.
Well, thank you. And, oh, God, there's so much I want to ask you right now. But, yes, yeah, so transitioning into talking about Dirty John, we talk about the victim's voice. We're going to talk a lot about Deborah and her daughters and her nephew. But one victim that I feel just has not had her voice heard is the sister, Cindy. And I really want to talk through her situation. We only get a little bit of a glimpse of what it was with her husband, Billy. And even, you know, Laura, even when we were talking to Christopher after we stopped recording, you know, he was looking at me like, I don't know what you mean about coercive control with Cindy and her husband. And I picked up the transcript of what the grandmother, Arlene, how she described what Cindy was telling her about Billy. And I just went line by line, and I thought, this is, you know, controlling what she wore. She couldn't wear a bikini. She couldn't go shopping. You know, she couldn't talk to anyone over, you know, it was all just there. But if you're not educated to see it, you know, of course people just normalized it. And, oh, that's just what a husband does. And even him, I mean, he shoots her point blank in the back of the head and then shoots himself in the stomach. You know,
right.
I don't know. That just pricked up my ears. And he calls 911 and says, I've been shot. You know, he doesn't say, my wife, I've killed my, you know, I don't know. What did you think about that?
Well, I mean, I found it fascinating just when you talked about it, that the way Chris actually described it, you know, what he said is, oh, one day he just, you know, put a bullet in her head and, you know, killed her. And that's how he described the whole scenario. And I've talked about it in training today because it doesn't just happen on one day. You know, the whole pattern and the history is always there. And it depends on what questions you ask and what you understand to be abuse. And of course, a lot of people still understand it to be physical violence. And the non-physical stuff, as you quite rightly said, gets missed. So he didn't just wake up one day and do that. She was trying to leave him. She was changing the dynamic in the relationship. She was speaking to people about that. He had been closing down her space for action, as it's called. and had been very jealous and controlling of her. And it's at the point of separation, when we have these kind of controlling and entitled individuals, it's at the point of separation that's the riskiest time. You know, I've got to really underline this, because 76% of the murders happen on separation, which is a big statistic. I found it and within the domestic homicides in 2004. And what's more, what's really important is that 2016, the piece of work that is called the Femicide Census by Carolyn Gala Smith also shows 76% of the murders happening on separation and 34% in the first month. Well, actually, I know that probably most of them happen within the first 3 to 4 months. And offenders work on the basis, well, yes, it's about control. Yes, it's about somebody feeling they're taking control. It's about their entitlement. And it's about finality, that when they feel they've got nothing left to lose, a catastrophic event can occur. And, you know, stood in training today, and I say it in every class, look out for finality and look out for last resort thinking, revenge motives. When someone really feels, you know, that somebody is about to shift out of their lives, that's the point where if they feel that they have nothing left, and it's not them losing control, it's taking control. So what I heard about Cindy, you know, was absolutely about his control, his domination, his closing down her world. And when she makes that point, you know, he's isolated her, and we see that in a lot of cases. So this was not a murder that just came out of the blue, as so many of them are described. And sadly, I've met with so many families, you know, one in particular that said to me as soon as they opened the door to me, this murder just came out of the blue, Laura. I mean, there were no warning signs. And then the minute, you know, I started asking questions using the dash, I found out there were so many high risk factors. And that's why our podcast training, you know, putting this into TV shows, raising awareness of the danger signs, the warnings. You know, it's for the mums, the brothers, the sisters, the best friends, as well as the professionals, so that when the Cindys and the Deborahs and, you know, the Jane Cloughs and the Alice Ruggles, when they reach out to someone, because they're talked to family members first, before they even call the police, that the right information is given.
He lied about everything, so who really knew? What unnerved people once they got in his bad side is how he talked about the mob's way of doing things, with a touch of real admiration in his voice. Like the mob's tactic of getting back at enemies, they didn't go after the enemies themselves. A dead enemy couldn't suffer after all. You went after the loved ones. You went after their families.
So, you know, this case has a real bearing of Cindy and Billy, because it obviously was a part of Deborah's background of having something so catastrophic happen in her life, but also the fact that forgiveness and, you know, her mother forgiving Billy, I thought that was very interesting. I've not seen a family do that quite so quickly, actually, as what happened here, but obviously there was a religious aspect. Now, Deborah may not have forgiven him, but she certainly seemed to see the best in people. And, you know, trying to see the best in people again, you know, and wanting love and wanting to be loved. You know, and I think she had a real sense of wanting to be loved and to give love. And her vulnerability was clear to me, even though she's a strong female. You know, she wanted to believe him when he was saying that he loved her and he needed her. Yeah, and we do want to, you know, we can't negate emotions in all of this. So I want to flip it on its head, because, you know, coercive control, I wanted to define it, because I heard Chris kind of saying, well, you guys talk about this, but I don't really understand it. You know, and I wanted to just say a little bit more about it, because it's not just about what somebody does. And, you know, coercive control is a strategic course of conduct that that can deprive someone or exploit them. Or dominate them. But it can also be dressed up as pseudo-caring behavior. It can also be by, you know, by isolating someone, and it can also be by preventing someone from doing or being or reaching their full potential. And so it's about what someone's stopping someone from being or doing. And it can be, particularly with isolation, incredibly subtle. So it could be, for example, we talked about today a case in class where the perpetrator chose a very isolated cottage you know, a little house that was far removed from everyone and everything, where no one could hear her screams. He chose that property for a reason, and he wouldn't let her even collect the post. He wouldn't let her talk to someone or anybody on the phone. He wouldn't let her, even when she started to work in a charity shop, he tried to get her out of the charity shop because he wanted her to himself. And he closed down all her relationships with people. And, you know, when we talk about Dirty John, you know, and Deborah in particular, the tools and the tactics that he used, well, firstly, one was charm. You know, charm disarms. And I talk about that in class. There's a Duluth, Minnesota came up with the power and control wheel, which, have you seen the power and control wheel? I think I may have shown it to you when we talked about Nicole. I mean, I can show it to you on the Skype. I put it up in all my classes, but you'll see the wheel there. And, you know, we put it up in classes. And physical and sexual violence is right around the outside of it. And the inside behaviours are things like, and I'll read it out to you, things like using emotional abuse. So putting someone down or making someone feel bad about themselves or making someone feel they're crazy or playing games with them. Using isolation. So things like stopping someone from, you know, having friends or involvement with other people outside, or using jealousy to justify their actions. Minimizing, denying and blaming. So it's always the victim's fault, not the perpetrator's, and making light of abuse. Using children, you know, of course, in Deborah's case, yes, I want to talk about her daughters because I think they're really interesting. Their radar's tweaking. But using economic abuse, and economic abuse can be, you know, taking someone's money or limiting their money, but it could be the other way around, of creating dependency. So, you know, he was looked after by her and he was trying to get as much money from her as possible, as, you know, for him to live the life that he wanted. But he was taking her to the bank and trying to take over her finances, gathering information and intelligence about her. And then you've got using coercion and threats, which, of course, he did whenever the other tactics didn't work, and using intimidation. And normally those things, particularly if we talk about Deborah, he used the people that she loved and cared about the most to try and control her. And one of the other things I always talk about that's not on the wheel is charm. You know, charm being the manipulator. And John had that in spades when we listened to what, you know, lots of other people said about him. Yes, it was superficial charm, but it was still charm, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. And he honed his craft over the years. Obviously, he had victim after victim to know what works, what doesn't, how far to push it. I mean, he was a master at recognizing people's weaknesses and vulnerabilities. It was astonishing.
He would exploit, and yeah. That's the thing. He would look for those things to exploit. You know, and actually in this case, there were just so many parts to it of, you know, people saying, well, they can't understand, you know, why she stayed. Well, lots of people say that about abuse, but the question really should be, why was he abusing?
Right.
You flip it on its head. It's actually about his behavior and not hers. And sometimes actually victims will stay because it's too risky and dangerous to leave. And that's a real paradox. But equally, he said all the right things. He loved her. He needed her. He wanted her to be in his life. You know, saying things like, well, I still love you and simply can't live without you. I don't want this. I want us without anyone else. I'm flawed, I know, but I'm not so easy to give up on you. When I met you, it was just about you. I love you and need you, please. You know, and this kind of pleading and, you know, I need you.
Right.
And, you know, it's understandable. When she had invested in him, she, you know, wanted a relationship with him. And we forget that love connection. He was everything she wanted him to be. He was chameleon-esque in knowing her idiosyncrasies, knowing her vulnerabilities, knowing everything about her. And that's what perpetrators would do. They would data mine and get that information. And, you know, he wanted to make himself indispensable to her. And, you know, he would compliment her, make her feel good about herself. And, you know, these are the things that people forget about. And so coercive control, you know, it is a set of behaviours that really can limit somebody and deprive them of things. But it can equally look like pseudo-caring behaviour, you know, and attentiveness. And he put her on a pedestal And he fitted into her life in all the gaps, knowing exactly, you know, her vulnerabilities, and that's what he exploited.
You know, I think I completely understand that. I completely, oh my gosh, you're talking about me in my 20s right now, you know. I mean, I completely understand being under that spell, and I think anybody can understand it. Absolutely. It's interesting. This story has brought out a lot of emotions from a lot of our listeners. And I think this, you know, Christopher lays out this story in a certain way so that you are supposed to be kind of flabbergasted that she stays and stays in light of all of the turmoil it's causing in her family and, you know, all of the things that her family's trying to prove to her about him. But I think I can completely understand why she stays. That doesn't mean that I'm not frustrated for her. You know, of course, he's laying out it out in a way that makes the audience go, oh, come on, I'm rooting for you to get away from this guy. And I think a lot of our listeners, well, you know, were like me and we're frustrated, but not blaming her. But a couple of our listeners like brought down the hammer on me, Laura. Oh my goodness. They're like, Lisa, you're colluding with the abuser and you're victim blaming. And I'm just like, you know, that's not what I'm doing, but I am having the reactions I have. And it's really for me after she leaves and she has to get away and she's hiding and she's in disguises and her entire family just goes through so much effort, you know, to get her out when she wants to leave and she's ready to leave. And then, you know, and as you say, it takes people a long time. They can go back and forth and back and forth. But, you know, that's something that's just really hard to, I mean, we understand it on one level, but on the other level, it's like, oh my goodness. And I started feeling like she's addicted. She's got an addiction. And that's the way I could sympathize with her. The sneaking around, the trying to hide it, the being in denial. It just felt like many of the addicts that I've known in my life, you know.
Right. And there is a thing called love bombing, you know, love bombing. And we talked about that in our training session today, where, you know, it is this kind of charm, this intoxicating charm, and, you know, really bombing someone with that. And, you know, it's very difficult. It is like a drug. It's kind of what you describe of when you are made to feel like $1 million, when somebody is putting you on a pedestal and actually doing and being everything that could possibly enhance your world, i.e., you know, he's taking her dry cleaning, you know, to dry cleaners, he's doing her banking, he's driving her car, he's making her life so much more enhanced in a way that, you know, is all she wants is somebody not to have that history of abuse and to be have a harmonious relationship with her daughters. And of course, one of them has a visceral reaction to him. But it is a form of love bombing and it is brainwashing. And Don Hennessy talks about it as a form of brainwashing. And I absolutely agree. You know, and it does come down to this very personal and idiosyncratic set of behaviors that, you know, it creates codependency. And he is exploiting all her needs, her neediness and what she wants. We all want to be loved, right? It doesn't matter who you are. We all want to be loved. So when somebody is enhancing our world to that degree and is charming and intoxicatingly so, he understands her vulnerability and sense of self. And she's isolated, you know, from her children. And he's great to her. You know, that's the thing. He persuades her it's everybody else and that he is great to her. And so you see what you want to see. How many times have we seen, you know, that you disregard all the things because you are, it's called, you know, love drunk, being love bombed by someone, and you disregard the things that don't fit. But actually, you know, in your instinct. And I believe that when she would look back at it, she would understand it. You know, why did her daughter have a visceral reaction? And I've got to say, the psychologist, whoever that person was that she went to see, had no business saying the things that she did about, you know, her daughters needing to be boundaried when she doesn't understand the type of individual that, you know, Deborah is having a relationship with. And so it's dangerous to say these things to someone. John Meehan, it actually says a lot more about him, his ability to manipulate and prey on people. And, you know, as we heard from many others, Deborah didn't make the best choices when it came to love. Well, I know a lot of people who don't either. But, you know, do you really expect someone to be a serial perpetrator of, you know, domestic abuse and stalking? Well, probably not. But what I will say, you know, to people who listen to our podcast is you just never know. And do your due diligence and check, particularly when you meet someone online, because they could be anybody. And of course, they could have a history. And that's why we've been campaigning for the register, because you don't know what you don't know. And this guy was a Jekyll and Hyde. He's the type of person that I've seen so many times exploiting her vulnerability, stopping her from being the true person that she could. You know, he didn't want her daughters around her. And we see isolation in a lot of cases. You know, there's one person who talks about it in my class, and she does a brilliant TED talk called Leslie Morgan Stainer. And on the TED talk, she talks about how she met this incredible guy, or she thought he was incredible, you know, the too good to be true guy, just like John, funny enough, you know, and then she finds out all these other things about him. But she said, he didn't move me away out of Manhattan to a place and say, right, I've done my Romeo and Juliet bit now, I'm through with that, now I'm going to stage two, isolation. You know, perpetrators don't put it in that vein. But it was a determined attempt. He doesn't want her daughters in her life. He doesn't want people interfering, because that impacts on the control. And certainly people who have a visceral reaction to him, like Jacqueline did, you know, and their instinct. You know, we always say trust your instinct. That's one of our golden rules. You know, if I told you that our stomachs have more brain cells than a dog's head, a dog's brain in our stomach, you know, that's why we call it gut instinct. You know, our mind will take, and we've said this before on a podcast, our brain will make a trillion calculations per second. We are summing up everything about a person, not just what they say, but things that don't feel right, things that might look right but don't sound right, everything about that person. And, you know, Jacqueline's gut instinct was bang on in this case, as was Tara's later on. So we want people to be highly attuned, but... You know, you think about charm. If somebody basically is charming and complimentary to you, that tends to increase likability. And perpetrators, you know, think about the last time someone paid you a compliment. You know, I say this in class all the time. If people are super complimentary to me, I always wonder, what is it that you want? That's always my first thought bubble. Because, you know, I'm 20 years profiling major crimes, seeing a lot of people, you know, who appear as one thing, these Jekyll and Hydes. So I do understand people's frustration. But when you work with clients and victims of particularly stalking and domestic abuse, so many of them, what you're hearing when they talk to you is the perpetrator's voice that's in their head, that's eroded their own thought patterns, their own, what they like, what they don't like, their sense of self. It's eroded all of that. That's why it's like brainwashing. And it takes a long time to wake a victim up, to start to hear their own voice when they've been coercively controlled. Always ask more questions about people. And, you know, my one rule is be very slow about the people you let into your life. Be very quick to eject them when you see that there's a problem, and go on your gut instincts and get them out your life very quickly. And I know that's a question that you want to ask me about. And I got to say, there was some support for you on Twitter, so don't feel you know, your reaction, you know, people did share, but that's one of the things that unfortunately does, you know, tend to lay a judgment on the victim rather than, and it lets the perpetrator go scot-free when we keep the microscope and lens on them.
Laura, that I think full stop that John Meehan was a psychopath who victimized this woman and victimized her family. She did nothing to deserve this, no matter how loving and vulnerable and blah, blah, blah she was, you know, full stop. But I think we should feel frustrated because we want to learn from this experience. Like you say, we learn that it's probably not a good idea to jump into a marriage with someone so quickly, no matter how good they're making you feel. We have to learn. You always are saying that. Where's the learning? And I feel like we should be able to recognize, oh, this, and this, even though, you know, if it was happening to us, we wouldn't have that perspective. But, you know, we have to have our normal reactions. It doesn't mean that we're blaming this lady, you know, my gosh.
But part of it, you know, it does come down to like a trauma-informed response of, you know, when we see people who've suffered abuse, you know, or let's put it even in terms of, you know, somebody with a black eye, let's put it in a physical sense of, you know, what did you do to get that is a question that gets asked rather than who did that to you. You know, and our language can very subtly, although we don't mean to consciously do it, we inadvertently we're focusing on the victim. And, you know, that's a real challenge because it means that we're not understanding the sophistication of the perpetrator, you know. And when we think about paedophiles, for example, sex offenders who prey on young children, well, it's not very sophisticated. You know, in essence, it's a trust dynamic. You know, the child can be exploited on a trust principle. I'm the grown up, I'm the adult, you're the child. Ergo, whatever I say as an adult, the child must do. But this is, you're talking about two adults who, you know, and in the main, you know, people who have already shaped their views and their thoughts and, you know, their likes and their dislikes and their beliefs and their, you know, and this is about somebody who subtly starts to erode those things and creates, you know, a codependency to the point that, you know, you might think that it's great that he drives her everywhere. Well, what if he is preventing her from getting a driving license? You know, what if it's actually about creating dependency? If I know where you are, I'm taking you everywhere, and it means that you can't talk to people because I'm with you all the time, and I'm taking you to the doctors. You know, all these things that limit someone's space for action, and they can be very subtle, you know, very nuanced things. And actually, when I've worked with thousands of clients, it's the little things that can be so distressing and have such serious psychological impact on someone. So, you know, the much smaller things that deprives them of their freedom of choice from being, right, and that kind of level of exploitation. And, you know, I think we've got to remember a lot of the particularly stalking and domestic violence and coercive control, these are patterned psychological crimes. You know, so I heard you talk about in the podcast, you said, well, you hadn't abused anyone, you know, and Chris made the point as well. And, you know, I was sort of talking to myself as I was running, probably looking like a crazy person, but saying, well, he did actually abuse people, and it's called stalking and it's called coercive control, and there is harm and damage there. It's just not on the physical sense until he got to this end point, which of course we hear about as the podcast unfolds.
Well, I think what if I'm remembering right, we were talking about how he was very blustery and was threatening to kick somebody's ass and this and that and that. And I thought it was interesting that he had so much bark, but, you know, we didn't see any arrest records of him, like, you know, fighting in a bar or actually hitting somebody. I mean, certainly he was completely abusive mentally and psychologically and all that. But I thought it was interesting that we didn't really see that physical part pop up that he would really have to be accountable for, you know. At least that wasn't in his record.
Yeah, well, I mean, he had stalked multiple people, hadn't he? He'd been on many felony charges of that. And you've got to remember that very few cases, you know, certainly in the UK, I can talk from that perspective, only 1% of stalking cases are crimed, and only 1% are currently being prosecuted and convicted. So it's actually, you know, our new law is taking time for people to use that law. But I think, you know, for the coercive stuff, the intimidation, when Deborah goes to see the lawyer with him and the lawyer suggests a prenup, you know, a postnup, wasn't it? There's one side that, you know, the lawyer says when he comes in and he's all very polite, yeah, but at that suggestion, the mask slips, and that's what I call it, the mask slips, and you start to see the true John, who he really is. And you look into the, you know, Jim called it the abyss. And yes, you look into the darkness, and actually that's the true person that he is. And that shows that his ability to wear this mask. But if he doesn't get, you know, he works around the power and control wheel. If he doesn't get what he wants, that's when the threats start, you know, and he'll try and, you know, use his bravado and use, you know, the physical sense of the threat to try and intimidate and get what he wants. And, you know, of course, there are lots of people who said, you know, he's one of the scariest men that they had ever met. Mm. And you've got to remember, we don't know what else he's been doing. Mm. You know, he may have physical assault, you know, history, and it wouldn't surprise me at all. But, you know, it's about people reporting it coming forward. But one thing's for sure, you don't just do the things that he did, you know, one day and wake up one day and start behaving that like that. It's a patterned crime. And, you know, the way that his sisters talked about him, you know, and the family and his significant relationships, they know him best and they hold a mirror up to him. And that's why it's so important to ask questions. You know, if you're in a relationship, ask the sister and the mother, ask people who know that person. They're the best baseline references you can get. And I've got to tell you, it's a big warning sign. If you're with someone and they have no friends, they have no one around them, you know, you're getting married and they bring no one to the church, And, you know, they're constantly talking about other people in their lives being crazy and that it's everybody else and not them. You've got to question it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it tells you that there is a problem, because it's not the case. It's going to be everybody else who's the problem, which is also what he said to Deborah. Right. You know, he explained it all away. It was everybody else and not him. And that's a classic psychopath who's, you know, it's not absolutely about being delusional. It's about somebody who is strategic and able to come up with a story each time to keep, you know, her under control and to feed her things that she believes, because she's naive and the other things she wants to believe.
That's the part, as we get later into the story, where she knows he's lying. That's the thing. And that's, to me, that's her addiction. Like, she knows that every single, this cannot be all of these excuses for why he has cyanide, why he's got the this and the that. I mean, she pretty much admits that in her storytelling, that, you know, she was afraid to sleep next to him at night. Just like, you know, the heroin addict is, you know, afraid of their needles and their kit, but they cannot be without it. And I mean, I still feel for her, but that's just what it reminded me of, that she just could not escape this addiction, even though she could see that it was just going to kill her in the end, or at least cost her a hell of a lot of money.
Well, it's interesting, you know, it takes on average someone 7 times to leave somebody, you know, particularly when there's abuse. It takes 7 times to move away from someone completely. And, you know, her tipping point, because there's always a tipping point. And, you know, what clients and victims tend to do is, when they are hearing from other people about somebody's behavior, they will always be assessing, always be gathering that information themselves, but they may not just be ready to leave just yet. And we want to talk to people, and we, you know, when we advise victims, we want to help them leave safely. And, you know, she's afraid of him. There's lots of things that she has to consider. But her tipping point is when he starts threatening her daughter, you know. And this is a key point, because perpetrators will use the things that matter most to the victims. You know, he's trying to sort of control Deborah and also the people around her. But that tipping point where the threshold has been met, enough is enough. And that's when she starts to make plans, you know, and she wants to leave him. So, you know, I hear from clients all the time, and I certainly, yes, it may be frustrating when you hear people, but they are the experts on their own situation. You know, they're the ones living it, in it, and knowing every piece of that information. And I have to say, for people like Julia Pemberton and Will Pemberton, who were shot dead by Alan Pemberton, this was in 2003, for 22 years, she had been safe with her own tactics that she had put in place. And it was all about coercive control. He'd never physically hit her once. But it's when she goes to leave, it's when she changes the dynamic, when she's standing up to him, you know, and he's saying, we will live together as man and wife until I decide otherwise. This is the time when he becomes much scarier. And even then, it takes her time to be able to leave. And police getting involved then escalated things, because on separation, we know the risk increases. He started stalking her, supergluing her locks, and he shot the 15-year-old son out on the driveway before tearing around the house trying to find Julia. And then as she is on the phone to the call handler, he rips the door open under the stairs and shoots her in the head at point-blank range and turns the weapon on himself. And a terrible, terrible case. But more to the point, she kept herself safe for all those years. And the tipping point was when she was trying to leave. So it's a real paradox. It can be a dangerous, you know, situation, and it escalates the risk. And so some people will remain within it because they know that. And, you know, with Dirty John, there's every reason, this Jekyll and Hyde character, you know, there's absolutely right reason for her to be fearful of him.
Absolutely.
And then I walked to the back license plate, and John came up and grabbed me by the waist, put his arm around my waist, looked me in the eyes, and he said, "Do you remember me?" And I didn't even respond to that. I just tried to get away from him. He started grabbing me, trying to put his hand over my mouth. I bit him. I was pushing him, trying to get away from him. He started to, like, punch me, I thought. But it turns out he he was stabbing me.
What could they have done differently? Could anybody have done anything differently when you listen to this story? I'm just wondering what we can learn from it that really could be applied. Not, and again, not to blame anybody for the choices they made, but it must have been just so incredibly frustrating and horrifying for her kids to watch this. I mean, is there anything else that they could have done?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the million-dollar question. And with every case, you know, different advice and safety planning plans are put together. You know, I listened to the debate about the restraining order, for example, and it being rejected. Well, it was deemed that he hadn't done anything physically to harm her or anybody else. Well, at that point, an expert should have been used to talk about stalking and coercive control. And even with a restraining order, you know, a restraining order is a piece of paper. And a piece of paper doesn't protect. And we've got to get away from thinking, you know, a piece of paper will do that. I was working with someone like Deborah. I would sit her down and talk about the power and control wheel. I'd talk to her about ask her about all the behaviors that were happening, use the DASH, the domestic abuse, stalking and harassment, and honor-based violence risk model. We would talk about her daughters, and we would think about a safety plan and the exit strategy for her to have a very planned approach to leaving. You know, John would be someone who would react badly to things like restraining orders. And of course, reacting badly means that he just carries on doing what he's always done. And that's why we've got multiple women who he stalked and who he abused. And you would want to use their cases as similar fact, bad character to build a case against John, you know, to ensure that all his behaviors were understood. And, you know, potentially knowing that there could be a tipping point here in this case, working closely with the police to even possibly put him under surveillance, because that tipping point could happen. And, you know, for him being arrested for the types of things that he was doing. And certainly once it got to the predatory stalking stage, where he was stalking her daughter, stalking her, you know, that actually we would have tried to do something much more overt around him. But also for Deborah, you know, I don't agree with hiding victims or disappearing them, but there could be a case for her going away for a period of time, either on a holiday or into a refuge or supporting her and her daughters. But this is exactly why people like John should be on a register, because his history should follow him and follow him. And that should have been disclosed to her, to Deborah, so that she understood that behavior. But you have a sex offenders register there, you're a few steps behind, but you know, here, that behavior, we would want it all on one database, so that when someone enters into a relationship, they can then ask the police. And we have a disclosure scheme as well, and putting them on VISA, which is our violent and sexual offenders register, having that history and focusing on the perpetrator is really important to ensure early identification and intervention and prevention. And of course, you haven't got the coercive control law. And, you know, one of my things that I want to chat to Evan about is Evan Stark, who you remember, he wrote the seminal book on coercive control. Well, Evan's been great, you know, coming over to England and Wales and to Scotland. And, you know, he was in Northern Ireland, I think, just after me, talking to the Justice Committee about criminalising coercive control and stalking. But you know, I would love him and I to work together in America with perhaps Deborah and other people to try and ensure coercive control becomes a criminal offence there, because I think it's a real irony, you know, and a big gap in the law that Evan, who, you know, talks so eloquently over here about, is, you know, what are we doing in America to ensure that it's understood and that it is seen as the serious crime that it is?
Well, yeah, not only from what you say, do law enforcement, do they need to be educated in what coercive control is and take it really seriously? And when they see this pattern of restraining order after restraining order, that they take her situation very seriously. But it sounds like the legal world also needs to know about it, because her lawyer could have said, okay, this is, you know, if he could have known about that too and built his case, you know, used all those restraints, you know. And I can't believe that they never actually arrested him for blowing up her car. I mean, what? I don't even understand that. If you remember, you know, they had him on videotape. He admitted that he had used the car, and that's such an aggressive, violent act. How right. That doesn't trigger anything.
And it's all part of the pattern behavior. And that's why, you know, with stalking, it's a real challenge because some of those behaviors might be then seen or, you know, crimed as criminal damage. You know, it's a piece of property and therefore it doesn't connect to stalking. But actually, you know, is that a message to her? You know, when her property, when her car's taken and her car means a lot to her, it's a very clear message to her. But the fact that he's skulking around, he's stalking, he's sat in cars, he's watching them, you know, he's doing all this really creepy stuff, which he's done with other women. He absolutely should have been arrested for that. And of course, you know, it's a California case, isn't it? You know, stalking is a criminal offence in California. And, you know, he could have been arrested and prosecuted. And I would have, you know, liked to have seen LAPD building the case with all the other, you know, his whole history. It's all relevant. It's relevant because it's patterned. And serial perpetrators, when they get away with things, they just keep doing it. And when they feel they've got nothing left to lose and everything's about to unravel, that's when the most catastrophic events can occur. And it's not always about your primary victim. You know, it can be about the victim, well, the others that the victim cares the most about, to create catastrophic devastation, you know, going after the people or the things that the victim cares the most about.
Right. I mean, I'm wondering in the back of my mind if he was planning to actually kidnap Tara and hold her for ransom, you know, and then kill her anyway, you know, in order to hurt Deb. You know, I'm not. It just seems so bizarre to me that he did what he did. I don't know if you had any insights about that.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to say I didn't find it bizarre in the slightest because I've worked so many different cases. You know, he went with a kill kit. He had been doing a lot of preparatory research, which we call stalking. He knew where she was going to be and at what time. He had been calling up where, you know, well, firstly, it was Jacqueline who saw him, wasn't it, and realised that he was around, and she calls Tara because she's so concerned and says, take your knife. And that gut instinct of just the way she saw him, the fact he's in the car, the fact his face is reflected on the phone, all the things that she's reading, knowing this guy means business, I better call my sister and let her know, you know, which she does. And the fact that he's been doing all this research, you know, he's biding his time. You know, and that's the other thing about perpetrators. They work on a matrix of, you know, once they get into this headspace, of last resort thinking and revenge and entitlement and I'm going to make you pay. Once they get there, they're at the finality aspect. And, you know, he's waiting for the opportunity for availability and accessibility. And a lot of stalkers will do that. And he's going after Tara to make maximum impact on Deborah. And he has what I would call a kill kit on him. You know, he's not just going to take her and, you know, abduct her and put her in the car. You know, if you've someone who's got passports and so on and so forth, he's going to disappear. And, you know, why? How would he try and take her with him? You know, it's very doubtful that that would happen. You know, this is kind of, he's thinking on a very short-term basis, although he has thought through the fact that he's got to disappear. Maybe the car, you know, I did think about the headlights being put out, the dashboard being damaged. You know, was he trying to make it look like the car had been stolen, potentially leave her body in the car, you know, and disappear and make it look like something else? You know, I agree with Jim. He's not criminally sophisticated and perhaps he doesn't have a full plan, but I certainly think it's about the devastation he wanted to wreak on Deborah and get back at her and make her pay attention to her slighting him and making her pay for what she's done. And, you know, that's the very clear message, this rejection that he feels from her and the revenge, you know, and this is the thing about the rejected and revenge stalker. They're very dangerous individuals. And he's got this real sense of entitlement and last resort thinking and finality. And these are the things, I've got this new risk matrix that has 10 critical points of risk. And the things I've just talked about, victim's fear level, then you've got coercive control. Then on separation, you've got stalking, the same types of behaviours, but on separation, and you've got escalation. But when you have a perpetrator in particular who then makes threats, you know, we know 1 in 2 of domestic violence perpetrators, if they make a threat, will act on it. Just think about that. 1 in 2, 50%, half. Here is John making these threats. We've got a revenge motive. He's a very entitled, narcissistic individual. And we've got last resort thinking. and he's a serial perpetrator. And these are the most dangerous of cases because victims get dismissed when they report it. You know, and they're also told things like, well, if he was going to do it, he would have done it by now. You know, and that absolutely is not the case. And these are all the things I say in a training session. So, you know, a really dangerous situation that's dynamic unfolding with gut instinct absolutely playing a part. And that's, you know, the concern. And as you say, going to a lawyer or calling the police, you would want them trained and equipped to ask the right questions and to know what to do and to call in specialists like myself, you know, Jim, you know, my team, if it's in the UK, who are, you know, specially accredited, independent stalking caseworkers who can advise on these cases, because they are the most likely cases to result in a murder. And, you know, I've been talking a lot because it's something I feel so strongly about, because all the hallmarks in this case were here, you know, or I should say present. And so many people, even Chris included, no disrespect to him, but even he didn't fully understand all the dynamics that were in play. You know, I'm just only pleased that Tara fought for her life. And, you know, even the way Chris described it of, you know, they fell to the ground. Well, no, they didn't. And people don't realize, you know, the adrenaline that pumps through your body in this time and the blink of the eye decisions that are taken. That there was no just falling to the ground. This was her fighting for her life. And fortunately, it had a very different outcome, thank God that she was so quick with her thinking and her commitment and determination that she didn't hesitate at any point, because otherwise it would have a very different ending. And, you know, she's very lucky and she's a very smart, intelligent and astute young woman.
Yeah, have you ever heard of that happening before where somebody has been stabbed? I mean, he stabbed her several times and she, you know, my heart goes out to her. She was able to turn it around and not only get away, but like stop him dead. I mean, I've never heard of that happening, you know.
I mean, not in exactly those same circumstances, but I do know cases where, you know, women in particular have fought their attacker off, you know, not necessarily killing them, but stunning them enough to be able to get away, mm-hmm. you know, and that's where, you know, things like, you know, self-defense training and things like that are really important, because it gets you your cellular memory into fighting back, because there is this, you know, flight, freeze, or fight dynamic that happens. The amygdala makes a decision. It's not even on a conscious level when adrenaline's shooting through your body. And, you know, you never know how you will react. But she, thank God, you know, not only takes control of the situation, her adrenaline, you know, kicks in and she keeps, you know, stabbing at him, which, you know, it's do or die. That's the situation that she's in.
Yeah, I mean, not that I would be inspired by that she killed him, but I am inspired that someone of her size can survive. And I think that's a very important message, that never give up, never, never, never give up. If somebody comes at you.
And always follow your, you know, your gut instinct. And, you know, the other point I did hear you make it, on the podcast, but it's just so important. You know, there's two points, but one is never go to a second location. You know, you get that one moment in the blink of an eye, and it once somebody takes you to a second location that they've planned or they've got an intention, then that's probably where they can get maximum control and you'll be more isolated. So fight at that point before they put you in a car or take you somewhere else. And if someone's got a gun, run for your life, because ultimately it's very difficult for someone to fire and fire accurately, particularly if you're zigzagging,
right.
You know, and so there are some things that we would say, and we've talked about it before on podcasts, but you know, it was clear that he was trying to you know, if he was trying to put her in the car, we don't know, but there was definitely, he took a knife with intent, and it was his intention to use it or either to get her in the car. And she was processing all of this in the blink of an eye. She makes these decisions and she is fighting. And yes, it doesn't matter what your size is. You know, sometimes it can be a lucky strike, but go for someone's eyes, go for their windpipe, their trachea, go for their crotch, go for the vulnerable areas where you know you're going to, you know, with your elbow, smash them in the face, you know, your hip, your knee, your feet, some of the strongest parts of a female body. but never allow them to take you to another location, because at that point, whatever it is they're going to do to you, they will have the control in that situation, and the likelihood of you surviving it, whatever it is, decreases significantly.
Right. Well, I know we have to wrap up now, and I just want to give a shout out to Deborah Newell, who shared this story with the world. And I think it's a very powerful story. I think we've all learned so much from it, and it's such a generous thing for her to do, and probably a very painful and difficult thing for her to hear her story out there, and receive criticisms or even the supportive messages. It's just, her privacy is now out there, and I'm so grateful, because she's just started all of these really important conversations, and thank God that she survived and her family survived.
Yeah, and I think that's, I totally echo that. I think Deborah's incredibly brave. She herself is probably still trying to come to terms with what it was and what it is, with everybody else, analyzing and making assessments and determinations and being very judgmental about what she did or didn't do. It must be very tough for her family too, everyone around her, to make sense of it. And, I hope they're all supporting each other, particularly at this time. And I think it's very brave, very courageous. And, I would be more than happy to talk to them at any point should they want to do anything around law change or become advocates, for others, because I think this is a tremendous case and story that needs to be heard, with fortunately a happy ending. Yeah. But I'm sure in many senses it doesn't feel happy to them just yet. But when they look back, they'll realize actually it was such an important thing to get people talking about what happened. And the shame is on him. The shame is his. The dishonor is his. The violence and abuse that he meted out on numerous, or multiple women, but also on men, this is all on him. And we must remember that and hold those individuals who behave like this to account for their behavior. They're the ones that are exploitative and abusive and getting away with it. And they're the ones that we should be analyzing and assessing and closing them down and saying that it's not okay to behave like that.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you so much.
It's been great talking with you. Your hair looks great.
Oh, thank you. I got a haircut.
It looks fantastic. It's been a long day here in London, but this is such an important case. I'm so pleased that we've got a chance, to talk in more detail, Lisa.
Yeah, me too.
So thank you very much. And, I'll just say to people, to keep looking on the Paladin website and also on Real Crime Profiles Twitter feed, because we're putting a lot of information on there at the moment. Jim's doing quite a lot of analysis about the Las Vegas shooter, and giving insight. And again, here's an individual where we hear about coercive control of women. It's no surprise when we hear the backstory there, although people are still trying to find motive. But it's very clear that this is somebody who had a superiority or God type complex. So, we're posting a lot on social media, and, you can continue to find out and more and support us more around the register. You can still sign the petition. Thank you very much for listening. This is Real Crime Profile signing off.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is, please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357 or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the Domestic Violence Hotline on 800-799-7233.